From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. You know, in the years I've served as a hospice chaplain, the hardest death of all is that of a child. And I've had some people who've lost children, and they would always say, a child is not supposed to die before their parent. Well, my special guest today unfortunately experienced that, the loss of her daughter at the age of 13. Her name is Molly Burke Maddox, and she lives in Noblesville, Indiana. She attended Anderson University, where she earned her bachelor's degree in Christian ministries with a minor in creative writing. Molly was an associate pastor at a small church in Indianapolis for nearly a decade before her daughter, Izzy, was diagnosed with neuroblastoma. She currently works in human resources and writes on the side, and I'm so grateful that she's sharing her time with us today. Molly Maddox, welcome to Journey's Fire.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I became known of your story, I think it was Instagram. And on Instagram, you have a page, Letters on Living After Loss. And because of my background and because of a lot of the speaking that I do on topics like this, it really intrigued me. And then I began to read your letters that you wrote soon after your daughter passed away. Boy, it just really, really spoke to me. And clearly it has spoken to a lot of people around the world because you're getting quite a following, I think. On a few occasions, and one in particular, I remember years ago, I had a hospice patient. He was 21. He was a graduate of Carmel High School, played on their football team. He was an IU student. And he had a rare form of heart disease to the point where he qualified for hospice. And I'll never forget that. That's the only time I've ever seen a medical director cry when he was talking about going to his funeral after he passed away. But I remember his mom repeatedly saying when he did pass, it's not supposed to be this way. A parent is supposed to outlive their child.
Yeah.
And I thought about that when I started reading your stories and then reaching out to you. So if you could just share from the beginning a little bit about your wonderful daughter and then when this journey began to happen, I believe she was 3 years old when you got the news.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's correct. So Izzy, her full name is Israel. We called her Izzy for short. So, yeah, she was just amazing, fiery little spirit, you know. She's full of grace and love, but also just sass. You know, just a nice blend of all of it. So yeah, really her almost entire life was fighting this horrible disease. So she was diagnosed in December of 2011. Her birthday is actually tomorrow, March 11th. But right after her third birthday, she started having abdominal pain, and it took 9 months for us to get a diagnosis just because she was 3 years old and abdominal pain is seen a lot, you know. So, yeah, eventually we found out that she had neuroblastoma. Which is a type of pediatric cancer that begins in utero. It's just clusters of nerve cells that don't fully mature. And so it was in her left adrenal gland. So that was what was causing, you know, the stomach aches progressed a lot over that 9 months.
Yeah.
The pain was getting a lot worse. So they just did surgery. She was stage 2B is what they called it. And so they said there was less than a 3% chance that it would ever come back. It was great that we found it. And that was it. And then they started scanning monthly. And 6 months later, it had come back, had wrapped around the kidney, and had spread to the bone. So 2012, she was four. We live in Indianapolis, but we began traveling to Cincinnati for treatment. We found a neuroblastoma specialist there. And so really, yeah, that's kind of how it all started.
What was it like, I can't imagine, as a parent, when you first got the diagnosis, when the doctor is mouthing these words that she has cancer and she's only 3 years old?
Yeah. You know, I was, it's one of those times where you hate it that you're right. You know, like I was right for 9 months. Like I kept telling people no one would validate that something was wrong, you know? And so it's like you've never, I've never in my whole life not wanted to be right before, you know, like I did in that moment. But yeah, I knew as soon as the phone rang, just because it was December 23rd. So it was right before Christmas. And they had said that it would be after the holiday before we got results. And he called immediately, like as I was walking in the front door after the scan. So yeah, and it's, I mean, it was very much like it is in the movies, you know, like you just kind of fall down and you can't believe it. and I think you just, yeah, I think the first, you know, she had surgery immediately. So like 2 days after Christmas, but I think really those first few days, there was just so much shock.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Cause you just can't handle that kind of emotion, you know? So your body just kind of shuts off.
Well, and at the time, it's really an unknown, right? Because
Yeah. You're
hoping for healing, but you don't know for sure because you know it's a serious diagnosis. And so you're taking it literally a day at a time, month at a time, a year at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You write, she was 3 years old. Her battle lasted 10 years over 6 relapses. I consider the first 9 years the fight and the final year the surrender. The last year of her life, I prepared her for death. At 12 years old, she embraced the end with hope for what could be waiting for her once her soul was released from her tortured body. Izzy died on April 1st, 2021, just 3 weeks after her 13th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about those years of going through treatment, going to Cincinnati, the ups and downs, no doubt. Not only of her physically, but also the emotions that you're going through.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, had we known the journey was going to last so long, I don't know that we would have chosen to go 2 hours away for treatment because it meant that her and I were isolated a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so when we first started traveling, I mean, my son was just starting kindergarten. And so, really, I mean, I missed most of his first year of kindergarten because we would be there for weeks at a time. And I think our longest stay there was for her stem cell transplant. We were there for 4.5 months.
Wow.
And he wasn't able to see her when we were in the hospital. He wasn't allowed on the floor. So yeah, I think in the beginning, the initial treatment was like 18 and a half months long. And I think you are just thrown into this world of cancer and your child has this and it's horrifying, but you still have hope that she could get better. Right. And so that was a fundamental difference about the beginning than, you know, fast forward 6 or 7 years. At that point, the hospital staff was like family to us. You know, we knew nurses and doctors so well.
Yeah.
We knew everything. We knew all the protocols. She knew all about labs and meds that she should have never known, you know, but she knew all kinds of things. We were very familiar with the world of cancer. But we didn't have the element of hope then, you know. So after her first, after it came back the first time is when we had less than a 1% survival rate. And I didn't tell her that because, you know, she was too young.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a lot of ups and downs. And really it was, I mean, from 2011, that December 2011, We never planned anything more than 3 months in advance because we always had scans every 3 months. And so we never planned a vacation. We never, we couldn't look into the future because we never knew.
So much was put on hold because of this.
Yeah. So you just keep telling yourself, like, okay, things are going to move on, right? Like, eventually we're going to get to this place. And it, I remember one time telling her doctor, I think in 2018, I had already prepared for the fact that, like, she was going to die. And we were beginning to have a lot of conversations, her and I, about the fact that the cancer probably wasn't going to go away. Which she just took to mean that she would have it for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they do this treatment, and all of a sudden she's in remission again, and he's so excited, and I was just, I was gutted. I remember taking him out in the hall, and I'm like, every time you do this, like, it is, do you understand, it's just as heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Because now we have hope, and she gets to live normal for 3 months, you know, and what next, you know?
Right.
So she was a very atypical case. I'm not sure they'd ever seen a case quite like hers before or even read about a case like hers, because generally neuroblastoma is very aggressive, and so kids either don't respond to treatment and they die, or they do, and it doesn't come back. I mean, there are cases of relapse, but they're, once you start, once you relapse, it doesn't go away completely again. Like, that's unheard of, the number of times that it did for her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So she would get to go to school because she had normal blood counts and, you know, do all of these things. And then it was just a constant roller coaster, you know?
Was Izzy able to go to school during this time?
She did. She was very behind academically because she missed so much school, you know, so she missed like half a year of kindergarten, you know, and then first grade was like a good year where she only, you know, would miss days every now and then, you know, but then second grade, she'd miss weeks here and weeks there. And so, she loved school. So she, cause she's just very social. She loved the social that component. So yeah, really up until the last couple of years. I mean, when COVID hit in 2020, it was I mean, I hate to say this, but it was good timing for our family because she had a drastic relapse where she wasn't able to walk at all, and no one was going to school at that time, right? And so that, for the first time, like, she felt included, and she was able to do, like, Zoom, you know, like all the other kids were doing.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So, so yeah, that was a really, you know, a hidden blessing for us because she was able to participate in the same way that everyone else was participating.
Yeah, yeah. And so, how did she handle this whole process herself?
It was really, I mean, it was all she knew, you know, all going to the hospital was all she knew. She lost hearing from chemotherapy during the stem cell transplant. So she started wearing hearing aids, I guess, in kindergarten, right before then. And she had a G-tube placed in her stomach, right away in 2012. So mostly she didn't like, what she didn't like were the things about her physically that were different. Obviously she didn't have hair a lot.
Yeah.
She didn't like that. She didn't like that she had the G-tube or that she couldn't hear well without the hearing aids. But the treatment stuff, she was just so used to it, you know? And so she loved going to the hospital when she was little because, I mean, she was adorable and she was always dressed up like a princess, you know? And so she got tons of attention. I mean, you know, she thought it was the greatest thing. And then we get there and And then, you know, she'd start getting poked and, you know, having to do stuff. And then she would remember, oh, right, this is horrible, actually. But
Yeah. Well, she was so young when the diagnosis came on that I'm sure, yeah. I mean, this was really all she knew at that point in as a young child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, and then it, you know, again, because her case was so atypical, that, and she was introduced to it as a toddler, mm-hmm. and then it was about the time she was 10 or 11, she really started putting up resistance and not wanting to go to the hospital anymore and not wanting to do treatment anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I remember talking to her about that and saying, you know, do you understand what will happen if we stop? And she said she did. I think she did on a certain level. You know, she's like, mm-hmm. I know that I'll die.
Yeah.
But that was when, you know, after talking to her team and talking to the psychologists at the hospital, we realized that she really was getting old enough that she needed to have a voice. Mm-hmm. In her treatment.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And once we started giving her choices, she chose what I would have chose anyway, right? But it was so empowering for her, right? To feel like she had a voice to say, we're going to have these conversations about what we're going to do to your body with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was so empowering for her. And then she decided she did want to keep doing treatment if we would, you know, if she could have a say in it,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah. So that, I guess she was probably about 10 or 11 when she wanted to start looking at scans and seeing, you know, seeing what was going on in her body.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And that's when she was able to say that's when it really began her saying, I will do this treatment, but I won't do this one because I know that this is hard. You know,
yeah.
I know how horrible this one was. I'm never doing that again.
Yeah.
You know.
There's another element I'm interested in, and probably because of my hospice chaplaincy background, but you've also been a woman of faith. You're actually on staff of a church.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you in terms of your faith in God? Was it ever tested? Did you ever question God? How did that evolve for you, your faith journey?
I don't know that you want to talk to me about that. nothing changed about what I believe in God.
Okay.
God never promised to make anything in this life easy for us,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's promised to be with us,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I started getting really frustrated with the narrative of healing that I kept hearing, you know, and people constantly wanting to pray for Izzy's healing. Because for me, we know that there's so much that we don't understand, right, about
mm-hmm.
so many things.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I had to cut it off because it was getting very confusing for her.
Sure. Sure.
And so she was like, well, people keep saying that if I pray this, then, you know, God will make me better. So he must not love me,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And so it started getting really, really frustrating for me. You know, but I remember she was probably, I don't know, 6 or 7. And I prayed the same prayer for her every night mm-hmm. of her life, even the night before she died, even though I knew, you know, she was dying. I still prayed the same prayer where I would declare life over her and ask God to fill her with life. So I was trying to teach her this prayer. And I said to her, you know, I want you to repeat every line that I say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, dear God, thank you for this, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she would repeat me verbatim until the very end. And I would say, and something like, and please help me to never have cancer again or something, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
We love you. And every time she would get to that last line and she would say, and we trust you, God, no matter what.
Hmm.
And it was infuriating to me.
Yeah. I bet it was.
you know, I was like, no, so I want you to say, don't let me ever have cancer again. And she was like, oh, isn't that what I said? And I'm like, no, that's not what you said, sweetie. So, no. But for her, she would never say it. She just kept saying, we trust you, God, no matter what. That was the last line every time.
Wow.
And for me, I was just like, okay, you know, like, this isn't about healing, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Like, God can still be... It's not amazing to me to say God is good if he's healed someone,
yes.
clearly, right?
Yes.
But if we can still stand in the darkness and still say, but God is good, mm-hmm. and my kid's dead, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the God that I serve. It's not this transactional thing. Like, you can be good because you did this thing for me.
Yeah, like, know? We're making a deal. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's not like that. There are definitely times I was frustrated with him and, I mean, and angry, just like, what are you doing? Like, let her go or make her better, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. make up your mind here.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I sensed his presence and his sovereignty, you know, through it all.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that she ended her prayers the way she did at such a young age. It's like she really had a deep faith, didn't she? She literally was surrendering no matter
what
to God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know a ton of adults that can't do that.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Izzy, I do really think she was able to see into the spiritual realm in a way that most of us can't.
Yeah.
And I don't think she recognized that, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are countless stories where she knew things that she shouldn't know. You know, like she would wake up singing happy birthday and I'm like, what is happening? Again, she's in like second grade, but she just can't stop singing it. And then we get down to the bus stop and she's singing it. And the grandma down there just starts crying because it was her husband's birthday. And it was his first birthday since he died. You know?
Oh, wow.
And so she just felt so seen in that moment.
Yeah.
And Izzy had no idea what she was doing.
Yeah.
You know? And Izzy, she did play therapy for a while when she was struggling with some of the, just afterwards she was lashing out a lot after that first 18 months of treatment. So just mm-hmm. trying to, you know, figure out how to process her emotions. And she would do the same things every week in the play therapy. She would bury all these tiny little, I don't know what they were, little figurines that were in this house.
Mm-hmm.
She would bury them in the sand. But the rule was, in play therapy, you have to clean up after yourself. So at the end, every week, she would take everything out of the sand and put it back up on the house, except for this one bride figurine, this tiny little bride. And the counselor would say, you have to get the bride too. And Izzy refused to get the bride. She said, the bride doesn't come back. She said, the bride goes away and she doesn't come back. And the thing is that like years later, we did this whole photography shoot of her in my wedding dress.
Uh-huh.
And so she is like, and I mean, I'm looking right now at a picture of her like in my wedding dress, you know, like those are my favorite pictures of her, as a bride. But I think her spirit, I think, knew that like she wasn't meant for this world. I think she always knew that.
She intuitively knew that. I've heard that before, especially with young people.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So.
And by the way, for our listeners, you can see a lot of those photos on the Instagram page I talked about, Letters on Living After Loss. Earlier in our conversation, I read something that you wrote. You also then go on to write, so we made the decision together to stop treatment in January of 2021. When given the option of another year, maybe, fighting in the hospital, or a few months of living life, she boldly chose the latter. And she knew what that meant. With the help of an amazing community of support, we were able to go to the beach for 5 weeks and do everything on her bucket list. This picture is taken from our hot air balloon ride during that trip. And that's the photo of you and your daughter that people are seeing on the website the podcast. Mm-hmm. After that, we were able to take her home to die the way she wanted, in our home with those she loved and not in a hospital. And during that time, she planned her own funeral and left specific instructions for what she wanted her legacy to look like. First of all, the maturity of this child is just amazing. And the courage also facing her own death. Can you share a little bit about what her thoughts were, like her own funeral and what she wanted her legacy to look like?
Yeah. So in 2020, we thought we were out of options. And so almost a year to the day, her doctor and I told her that she was probably going to die very soon.
Yeah.
And that did not go well, obviously. She was terrified. And come to find out, we found an option that we started 3 days later, and everything was fine. And we were, you know, able to get her back to a good place for a while. But she already had that knowledge. Like, we had already told her, you know, and you can't take that back. So there were so many conversations that took place from May of 2020 until she died in April. And one of those things, that summer, a couple months, in the summer of 2020, one night, and we were laying in bed and talking, and she finally realized at that point, when they say there's no cure, they don't mean I'm going to live with this forever. They mean eventually I'm going to die, you know. So she asked me to put cat food on her grave every day because she really wanted cats to still come see her. She loves cats. And she wanted them to be cared for, you know, to still feel like she was taking care of them.
Yeah.
So now you fast forward to a couple weeks before she died, and she decided to be cremated because she didn't want her body to slowly decay underground. She thought that was creepy, and she just wanted to be cremated.
Uh-huh.
But I said, okay, well, what about the cats? Because you had, you know, told me to do this with the cats. So she wanted, instead of flowers for the funeral, she wanted donations to go to the Humane Society. So,
wow.
That was, so really what she wanted was she wanted, you know, animals being cared for.
Yeah.
You know?
What maturity she had at such a young age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she was able to just say, you know, what she wanted done with her ashes, you know? So we looked at jewelry websites. She wanted me to have part of her in a ring, and she wanted very certain people in our family and her best friend to have a piece of jewelry with some of her ashes in it, you know? And we planned an outdoor, she wanted a service that was outdoors. She wanted her favorite cat to be there. And the other thing that I think was really empowering for her is she wanted to be able to tell her friends that she was dying. And that, I think that was probably one of the hardest things, to observe, you know, so we had all of her friends over. There were 7 or 8 of them in the living room, and they all knew that she was.
Yeah.
But she wanted to say the words to them, you know, to say her liver was failing and to say, you know, I'm going to die. And I want you guys at my funeral. I want you to all wear bright colors. They started talking about dresses that she wanted, flower prints and stuff like that. She didn't want to waste money on flowers, but she did want 13 dozen roses at the funeral, pink roses, since she was 13. So just little things like that. But she just very matter-of-factly, those last 10 days when we realized it, she was only home on hospice for 10 days. You know, we cried at the hospital, but then she never cried again. And I really think there was just a veil of grace over her. I think that was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it was because we had talked about it for so long, you know, Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was normal for her, you know, to think, or she was just a prisoner in that body. And so to think that she could be free, was really exciting for her.
So. Yeah, I bet. Boy, I know a lot of adults that wouldn't be able to handle how she handled the end of her life and inviting her friends over to want to talk to them personally. I mean, again, I'm just blown away by the courage this young lady showed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When, after she passed, mm-hmm. when did you start writing the letters to her?
Like 2 days later.
Did that just, you just got a download to do that? Is that how that happened, or?
I've always, like, either, I mean, I used to journal a lot.
Uh-huh.
But then what I found is that with everything going on with her for years, I got into a rhythm of processing it.
Mm-hmm.
Where I would come home and I would formulate everything into like a social media update, right?
Yeah.
And so, and I didn't have like a big following or anything, but this is just my community. But for me to put it all down in words into a nice little box, then I felt somewhat in control, right? And that just became like a part of my rhythm. That was a part of how I processed this. So as soon as she died, I started writing letters to her in my journal. And I just thought, well, what if I posted one of these, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and then I continued to for a couple of weeks, and people really seemed to, like, identify with what I was saying,
yes.
you know? And which is sad and beautiful, right? So it feels good that someone else gets what you're saying, but it's also sad because this is horribly painful, and to know that this many people identify with it is just sad, you know?
Yeah.
And they really just started coming out of me pretty effortlessly. You know, it just became like a daily thing every morning. Probably for the first 6 weeks, it was every morning. I would just sit down for a half hour. I would write her a letter. I would cry my eyes out. And then I would feel a little better, like that pain had gone somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
And I still felt connected to her. And then I kind of would say, I think I'm going to stop the letters. But I just couldn't. Like, they kept flowing. I never really could, you know? So, but then I eventually just gave myself permission, you know, to write on days when I felt like it, on days when I was like, oh, I don't have time today. You know, I started working again eventually part time, and just giving myself permission to not do it. You know, I didn't want it to be something forced. I wanted it to genuinely be something that just like came out.
Yeah.
You know?
Did you find it comforting?
Oh, for sure.
100%. I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
I would think
so. Yeah. And I think because I was doing it, and I still am doing it so regularly, and I sit down, I write it, I do it. I'm not trying to perfect them. And I like to write, but a lot of times when I am writing something, you know, I want to perfect it, right? Uh-huh. And I'll edit it over and over and over and over again. And I just didn't do that. I don't do that with these.
Yeah.
Like, there's some editing, but this is just my heart. And I've just accepted that some letters are not going to be as good as others. But that's where I am today, right? So,
well, the letters are all from the heart. I mean, that's why you're on this program with me, because I was one of the many that was deeply touched by everything you've been writing. What has been the response so far from people who are hearing about your story and reading the letters? I'm sure they're reaching out to you, many people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing that I hear, you know, multiple times a day is just people say, thank you, you are able to articulate what I feel, you know, about their own loss. Most people that are following, it is because they have experienced a loss, a significant loss, not necessarily a child, maybe a parent or a partner.
Yeah.
But there's something, and people will say, like, I tell myself, I'm not going to read them anymore, but then I can't stop, you know? They're like, I'm not going to do this because I always cry when I read them, but then, yeah. You know, they say, but I can't stop reading them. And I think I've just tried to not make it pretty and just, this is what I feel today. I'm sad because I saw her toothbrush, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, I think there's an element of simplicity to that people can relate to, right?
Yes.
And they're just like, I get that. Like, nobody talks about the toothbrush, you know?
Yes.
Like, why doesn't anybody talk about the toothbrush?
It's those little things like that, right? Yes.
It is,
yes.
Right? And so for people to say, yes, I get it, you know?
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the bulk of people, some people follow just because they're intrigued, you know, and they like it, or they followed us for a long time. But the bulk of people that are and engaging with are people that have experienced loss. And
yeah.
And, you know, I think so many of us have believed this lie that grief is like this phase that we go through that lasts a few, you know,
yeah.
A year, I think, is like the time when it's, you're supposed to be over it.
Supposedly. Yeah.
Right. And it's like, and it's not true. Like,
absolutely not.
No. And someone I heard describe recently, you know, she said it's grief is a new emotion that is now one of your emotions. So it's an emotion that you've never known before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now that you know it, you always will, you know? And so, yeah, I think some of the people that are in the little online community that I'm building, you know, they've had a parent gone for 8 years or whatever, you mm-hmm. know, but there's still things that they haven't processed,
yeah.
or they still miss them.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I see our time together on this program in two parts. The first, I absolutely wanted to celebrate the life of Izzy, this precious little girl who showed so much courage going through so much. The other part, though, is your continuing grief journey yourself that you're going through. And that's why we're getting into the letters that you write to her.
Yeah.
I asked for some letters. You didn't send me all of them, but you sent me quite a few, and I've been reading them. You also sent me in a separate email something that I think you said was the last 10 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that, and there's also a letter you wrote just 2 days after her death dated 4/3.
Yeah.
So I'd like for you, if you have those with you, mm-hmm. Which one would you like to read first?
I think I could do the 4/3 one first.
Okay.
I could do that.
All right.
So, yeah, so 4/3 is probably, let's see. Yeah, so this is probably, I think, the first one that I wrote, mm-hmm. that I posted.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed the letters. Can I talk about that?
Please.
The way I signed
them.
Okay. So I signed them, I love you every day forever. And every day forever is what she said to me the day before she died. She wrote out this little thing that we used to say to each other, I love you more. She wrote out, I love you mostest of all. And she, in her handwriting, and I was going to get it tattooed on my arm, and she signed it Izzy. And she said, and then you can read this and remember my love for you every day forever. And so every day forever is now like my thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's how I end my letters, with every day forever, because she said that when I look at my arm, you know, I could remember her love every day forever. So anyways, that's how I sign them. Okay. So 4/3, dear Izzy, you have been gone for 51 hours and 56 minutes, and I miss you. I've started writing to you each day, telling you all the times I feel your absence and all the times I sense your presence. Mostly I just write that I miss you over and over again on the tear-stained pages of my journal. I never knew that this is what losing you would feel like. I imagined it to feel like a great emptiness, but this feeling is actually the very opposite of emptiness. This feeling is a crushing fullness. It's like a million rocks piled up on my chest. Old realities turned to stone without your breath. All the things you used to say, rock, the way you'd smack your lips together from across the room to send me a kiss, rock, your voice, your eyes, your love for me, rock, rock, rock. I don't know how to do this, and honestly, I don't want to find out. I don't ever want to learn to live without you, but I commit to learning to live because of you. Because if you could walk so graciously towards your own death, then the very least I can do is this, and I will. I love you every day forever, Mama.
Wow. Yeah. And each time when you were led to write, it just poured out of your heart.
It did, yeah. Yeah, really, it really truly did.
Yeah, yeah. Can you read the one that's about the last 10 days?
Yeah. I don't remember the date on that one, but I thought it just captured, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's a good one. It's a good recap. So, dear Izzy, the conversations we had at the end play over and over again in my mind. I hear your voice, see the acceptance on your face, feel the helplessness that consumed me. It was 10 days. 10 days from the time I told you there was nothing else we could do. We sat together in the hospital recliner and held each other. We sobbed. You asked me all your questions. What would happen to your body? What would happen to your things? What would happen to the people you left behind? After that, I cried every day, all day. But you never cried again. You laughed and suggested I buy 12 boxes of Kleenex because you said I would need them after, quote, it happened. I have very few pictures of you during those 10 days. You took so many pictures, but I just couldn't, because each day you looked a little less like yourself. Each day, the tumors in your skull grew bigger. They looked like golf balls coming out of your head. You loved it when I rubbed your fuzzy head, but during those 10 days, it hurt. It hurt for me to touch the tumors. During those 10 days, everything I did hurt you, because your body was shutting down. Looking back on it now, it was almost like your soul separated a little more from your body each day. You promised to watch over me, to be my guardian angel and protect me for the remainder of my life. You made me promise to be nice to your cat, Elsa. Gave me instructions for everything you wanted to happen after you were gone. I sobbed during all of these talks, but you didn't cry, not once. You weren't happy, but you were at peace. I hear those conversations over and over again each day. I'm learning techniques to stop them. But I feel guilt in that. I feel like I'm silencing you. But I have to stop reliving those final moments because I'm drowning in them. The beauty in your death is that you are free. But to keep reliving your final days prevent me from ever being free. For 10 years, I gave all I had to you. But for 10 days, you gave all you had to me. It's quite beautiful, really, that I work to prepare you for death, and you work to prepare me for life without you. I love you every day forever, Mama.
Wow. And you worked to prepare me for life without you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am so moved by all the letters that I've been reading that you're writing, because it is from your heart. They are unedited.
Thanks.
But they're
Thanks.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
What has this, because it's not even quite been a year yet, what's this grief journey been like for you?
I think it's it's been different than a lot of people's experience with grief, probably. Because this, you know, people say, you know, you hear a lot, like losing a child, that's the most horrible thing that can happen to you. But I would argue it's not. I would argue watching your child suffer for so long, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, people say, how do you get out of bed in the morning? Like, how are you not curled up in a ball crying in the kitchen floor? I was doing that a year and a half ago, you know.
Sure.
Because I couldn't save her, and she was, you know, suffering all the time. She couldn't walk to bed. I was carrying her to the bathroom. I was having to bathe her. I mean, so yeah, I am grieving. I still cry almost every day, but there is a weight that is lifted now because I'm not watching her suffer, right? And I'm not waiting for her to die. And I was literally waiting for her to die since like 2014, you know? So it's just been different. It's been unique. And so I think it's allowed me to look at all of death in this very unique way. And I'm just very passionate, not so much about the grief process, but the end of life process and how we prepare for it and acknowledge it and talk about it. You know, There's so little out there until you get into the grief books, right?
Right.
But what about before that? Like, how many, Izzy's not the first person that's known she was going to die. Mm-hmm. So I'm not the first person that's walked a loved one there, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just realize we have this need in our culture, this refusal to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make it go away, you know? I feel like, you know, the grief has been, it's hard. It's horrible living without her. But I am empowered. Like, I see something that I can actually do something about. Mm-hmm. I can talk about this, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't do anything about her cancer, right? But I can keep talking and I can keep writing about death and how it's just a part of life and we need to treat it like another part of life.
Do you think there's a lot of people still that are just afraid of death? And because of that, they don't want to talk about death. They'll talk about anything else but death. And yet it's the one thing we all have in common.
I know, right? It's the one thing. Yeah, I do. And you know, I was even talking to my dad about my passion for this, and he's like, nobody's going to want to, like, who's going to come listen to you talk about death? Like, nobody wants to do that, you know? Like, that's so sad. And I'm like, but the more we talk about it, then it loses its hold over us, you know?
Yes.
And there are some people, there is a small group of people, because I polled everybody on Instagram once, and I was like, why are you following me? That said, because I'm terrified of death. And you're helping me to see it through a new lens, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think, I think it's perfectly normal to be afraid of death. Like, that's totally normal. It's just nonsensical to think if we don't think about it or talk about it, then we won't have to deal with it.
Right. We just want to keep it in the closet.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh. Where there's something beautiful and innocent about children who just accept things as they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing about Izzy, I think, really, you know, her legacy, she wants to feed cats. She wanted cats fed. We're going to keep doing that. Right? That's what she chose. But when I look at her life and I look at the legacy that I think is so much bigger than her, that she's contributing to and that she's leaving behind, it's embracing death as another part of life, you know?
Absolutely.
And because I think that's why people don't ever want to choose to stop treatment, right? Because they don't want to die. When Izzy finally got to this point where she just didn't want to be in the hospital anymore, you know? She wanted people to leave her alone. I mean, she was tired of all of it. And so for a child to be able to say, I'm done. Like, great. Take me to the beach and let's not do any more chemotherapy, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that was a choice that you allowed her to make. She said, I don't want any more treatments. You know, where some people might be so scared, they'll hang on to the last treatment without really being healthy enough to experience life. But she wanted to experience life and had those beautiful five weeks to do that.
Yeah, and I think there's always, like, this balance where it's like, what is the treatment doing? Like, is it contributing to quality of life?
Yeah.
And for a long time, it really was. Unfortunately, for the last year, it wasn't. It was her body was too tired, and it was not recovering from treatment. And so she was constantly having complications. We were in the hospital all the time. And finally, I talked to her doctor, and I talked to her, and I said, do you want to go home, and we'll just go to the beach for a month, and we won't do treatment anymore?
Yeah.
And I said, and you know, if we stop, and she's like, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, I just do it. Let's go.
Yeah.
And we literally packed and left that night.
Yeah.
So.
What do you share with people who say, I don't know what to say to so-and-so?
Yeah.
They've just found out they're terminal, or maybe it's a daughter or son they have. And I think it's awkward for a lot of people. They want to support you, right? But they don't really know what to say, and they end up sometimes, not intentionally, but saying the wrong things.
Yeah. I've learned, and I've certainly made the mistake too of like saying the wrong thing. I mean, I think it's better to say the wrong thing than to say nothing.
Yes.
First of all.
Yes.
You know. But I think the big mistake that we all make, it's just how we're wired, and we do it with everything, not just with death. We want to say something to make it better.
Ah, yes.
And I encourage people, just don't do that. Don't try to make it better. You can't. So, like, don't even go there.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
Don't say, well, at least, you know, any sentence that's going to start like that. No. I am so sorry. I see your pain. I'm here. This is horrible. This is not fair. You know? That's really what I tell people. Just don't try to make it better.
Yeah.
You know? Because that's what feels so invalidating, right? When you're hurting so much. And no one does it intentionally. But
right.
It feels like they're invalidating that pain, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, I know that Izzy isn't suffering anymore, and I have known that from day one. But if people would have, like, told me that the very first day, at least, it's not anyone else's place to say that. They can think it. They can know it. I can know it.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes right past our pain when we say those things out loud, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of my favorite writers and teachers was a man by the name of Andre Nguyen. He passed away some time ago, but he wrote a lot of profound books. He was a theologian. And one of my favorite Andre quotes is this. He said, when we honestly ask ourselves which person in our lives mean the most to us, we often find that it's those who, instead of giving advice, solutions, or cures, have chosen rather to share our pain and touch our wounds with a warm and tender hand. The friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face with us the reality of our powerlessness, that is a friend who cares.
That's beautiful.
I just love that quote, because in all the work that I've done with hospice, that has made the most sense to me.
Yeah.
And just to be there.
Yep.
And to say I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, too, I've had a background, a pretty extensive, varied background in my spiritual walk with God. And there was a time when I was in charismatic church, and there was a lot of name it, claim it people, and almost refused that anyone was going to die. And I said, well, wait a minute. What about all these faith teachers
right.
who died a long time? Nobody lives forever.
No, right.
So, you know, these mindsets people have instead of, and the older I get and the longer I walk with God, the more I appreciate words like surrender.
Yeah.
And also impermanence, because nothing does last forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's what got to be so confusing for me about the whole healing thing is, it's like if we're so excited about God, you should be excited that she's going to be with him. You
yes.
know what I mean? Why are we the least excited? Like, why are we the ones that are like, no, don't die. You can't do that. We got to pray that you stay here. Like,
I know.
We should be the ones that are jumping up and down and saying, yes, you're finally, you know, get to be free. So
I will have families do that with a 99-year-old grandfather who wants to go, and they're, no, you can't go, my God. And said,
yeah.
I'm sorry, he's 99.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
We hold on,
I mean,
don't we?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just not, I mean, this is the way God designed us. Like, we have bodies, they naturally slow down, right?
Yeah.
It just happens every day, mm-hmm. you know?
That's true. That's right.
And so I'm like, this is actually the design. I don't think it goes against, like, God's plan, right? Nobody wants a child to be sick. No, but again, we don't know why any of these things happen or why they happen to certain people. But ultimately, I do know that we were all created to die.
Yeah,
so,
right. We were born to die.
Absolutely.
And what I've learned also is that life and death are all part of the same coin.
Yeah.
And I say thank God for the death positive movement. There's actually a worldwide movement that you're going to be a part of if you aren't already and don't even know it. People who are experiencing these kind of things, but also sharing with the world their own experiences about not being afraid, about embracing it all.
Yeah.
And I think we definitely need to be doing that. I'd like to close our conversation with you reading one more letter. It's dated 2/12/2021.
Okay.
Yeah, if you could share or read that, please.
Dear Izzy, you were magnificent. From start to finish, pure magic. What a privilege it was, what an honor, to be the one that you called mom. You were quite literally a piece of me, a piece that's gone now, a piece that's missing forever. I'll never again be whole. I know this. Every day I know. But I feel it differently on different days. Some days, sometimes, your absence feels like being lost, like I don't quite know where I fit, don't know if I'll ever fit anywhere again. Sometimes your absence feels like pain, like an ache in the center of my chest, there from the moment I open my eyes in the morning to the moment I close them at night. Sometimes your absence feels like a fire, burning deeply in my soul, calling me to create something beautiful in that space in my heart where you used to live. Sometimes your absence feels like being numb, like going through the motions of each day, but never participating, never fully investing in the moment. Sometimes your absence feels like being breathless, like going on a long run without my inhaler, like wanting to take a deep breath, but my lungs hurt too much to fully expand. Sometimes your absence feels like weakness, like it did today, when I stopped halfway up the stairs and fell to my knees. I sobbed there for the longest time, thinking about your life, thinking about your death, about your smile, about your last breath. 3 or 4 more stairs and I would have been to the top, but I didn't have it in me. And I knew you wouldn't be at the top of the stairs. I knew you wouldn't be at the bottom of the stairs either. So I stayed right there in the middle. As I sat there, I remembered something I read in your journal, how you wrote you wanted to be able to walk up the stairs again without it hurting, without having to catch your breath. So I cried in the middle of the stairs for all the steps you weren't able to take without pain. For all the steps you'll never be able to take again. I cried for how much I miss you. I cried for how much I love you. I cried in the middle of the stairs because sometimes your absence feels like that. I love you every day forever, Mama. Hmm.
Molly Maddox, I want to thank you so much sharing your story with our listeners and helping us to really see in a beautiful way this beautiful young girl who showed so much courage, and also to appreciate the journey that you're on. For people who want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to reach out and contact you?
Probably Instagram.
Okay.
So on Instagram, it's Letters on Living After Loss, and I am all over my messages there. I'm also on Facebook. That page is just called After Izzy. But I don't have nearly as much stuff out on Facebook. On Instagram, I do Q&As and I do little videos.
Yeah.
So there's more content there. But either way, I'm good about messaging.
Mm. So. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was an honor.
And that's today's program. If you'd like to reach out to Molly, she doesn't have a website yet, but you can get her on Instagram, Letters on Living After Loss. That's on Instagram. Or you can reach out to me on my website, and I'll get you some more information than that, too. But I want to thank you for joining me today. I also want to thank my amazing engineer, Genesis Brown, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Rendon. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.